It's 55 degrees in Phoenix at 11 o'clock.
The recent measles outbreak was a public health issue, so is preparing for a possible Ebola crisis. And when Arizona voters approved medical marijuana use, the State Department of Health Services had to organize the system. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Will Humble, who just completed a lengthy run as the director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Plus, the Morrison Institute for Public Policy is far from a new think tank, but with a new water policy center and a new quarterly public poll, it may seem that way. I'll talk with Director Tom Riley about the Institute's revamped mission. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this week about Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission, which voters approved 15 years ago. Has the commission accomplished what it was supposed to? I'll ask someone who was present at the creation. And Arizona has a lot of intriguing places and stories, but did you ever think of it as a chimichanga? Writer Ken Lamberton makes the case in his new book, Chasing Arizona. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In a startling opening statement in the Boston Marathon bombing trial, the defense says its client, Jahar Tsarnaev, did it. One of Tsarnaev's attorneys told the jury today that it was him. He committed the crime. But the defense and prosecution differ on why. Tsarnaev's team blames it on Tsarnaev's older brother, Tamerlan, whom he inadvertently killed by running him over as they were trying to escape police in the aftermath of the 2013 bombings. Earlier, the prosecution used their opening statement to describe a horrific scene at the race, accusing Tsarnaev of believing himself to be a soldier in a holy war against Americans as he planted a homemade bomb. Three people died. More than 260 others were wounded. The U.S. Supreme Court appears divided on ideological lines as it considers today's second major challenge to the Affordable Care Act, widely known as Obamacare. The latest argument involves a law targeting tax subsidies intended to help Americans buy health insurance if they don't get it from the government or their employers. Julie Robner of Kaiser Health News says there were no clear signs, though, on how the court was leaning.
It was very difficult to tell from today's arguments where they were going. Justice Roberts was uncharacteristically quiet. He said almost nothing. And Justice Kennedy had tough questions for both sides. So we may have to wait until we see the court's decision. That'll probably be in June to know what they're thinking.
Julie Robner reporting. Losing a body part in a workplace accident results in dramatically different workers' compensation benefits from state to state. NPR's Howard Berkus reports that's what ProPublica and NPR found in an investigation of changes in workers' comp benefits across the United States.
Workers' compensation is run by states with no federal minimums for benefits. Each state calculates values for each body part and pays a percentage of lost wages for specific periods of time. That varies widely, even for neighboring states with similar costs of living. So one worker who lost an arm in Alabama qualified for $48,000 in compensation. But across the border in Georgia, a worker with the same injury could collect $750,000. A big toe is valued at $6,000 in California, but more than $90,000 in Oregon. Federal minimums were recommended in the 1970s, but they've largely been abandoned as states trim workers' comp benefits to retain and attract employers. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Officials in Ukraine reporting at least 10 workers have been killed after a methane explosion tore through a coal mine before dawn today. The blast took place in eastern Ukraine, which has been the scene of battles between government troops and Russian-backed separatists in the region. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was down 93 points at 18,110. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Unisys Corporation, maker of Unisys Stealth cybersecurity software. You can't hack what you can't see. Learn more at unisys.com/stealth. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The exact point at which humans evolved into our current form has been debated. But now a team from ASU has made a new discovery of something very old, which may help answer the debate. KJZZ's science and innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier reports.
An international effort led by ASU researchers uncovered a jawbone fossil that changes the original thought of when humans evolved into our current genus Homo. The lower left half jawbone contains five teeth and carbon dates to 2.8 million years ago. Bill Kimball is with ASU's Institute of Human Origins.
It's the earliest fossil representative of the genus Homo that has yet been found. It pushes back the probable time of origin by at least 500,000 years.
Kimball refers to genus, which is a biological grouping of similar species. He says the dig area in Ethiopia carbon dates 2 to 3 million years ago, where humans' fossil record is poor. With the quality of the find, Kimball says this is a big discovery in human evolution.
It helps us narrow the time in which we should be focusing our research to define the exact time and place of origin of the Homo lineage.
The jawbone is similar to the famous Lucy, an early hominin skeletal find made nearby. While Lucy was a different genus and dated 200,000 years earlier, it's also like early versions of our own genus, such as Homo habilis and Homo erectus, leading to our own species, Homo sapien. Andrew Bernier, KJZZ News.
The complete report of this find is being published today in the journal Science. The Arizona House has scheduled a vote today on a bill allowing payday lenders barred from operating in the state under a 2008 voter initiative to offer a new loan product. Today's planned vote on Republican Representative J.D. Mesnard's proposal comes after a heated House debate on the proposal last week. Democrats argued voters wanted high interest rate loans barred from the state when they rejected payday lenders. This is KJZZ News.
KJZZ is supported by the Maricopa County Home and Garden Show this Friday through Sunday at the University of Phoenix Stadium. From outdoor living to kitchen and bath remodeling, hundreds of local home improvement exhibits and seminars. Info at mchomeshows.com.
Fair skies in the valley right now, and it's 60 degrees at KJZZ at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the Arizona Department of Health Services has been the go-to agency for the recent measles outbreak and preparing for a possible Ebola crisis. And when Arizona voters approved medical marijuana use, ADHS also implemented the policies. I'll talk with Will Humble, the man who directed the agency for the past 6 years. Tuesday was his last day. Plus, the Morrison Institute for Public Policy is far from a new think tank, but with a new water policy center and new quarterly public poll, it may seem that way. I'll talk with Director Tom Riley about the Institute's revamped mission. Also, Arizona has a lot of intriguing places and stories, but did you ever think of it as a chimichanga? Writer Ken Lamberton makes the case in his new book, Chasing Arizona. We start today's program with a look at Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission and how it came to be. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments related to whether the IRC is constitutional. With me to talk about the commission is Bart Turner, who was present at its creation as co-author of the Citizens Ballot Initiative. He joins us from Washington, D.C., where he attended the Supreme Court hearing. Hi, Bart. How are you?
Hey, Steve. I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
So take us back more than 15 years. How did the ballot measure and the IRC get started, and what was the tipping point for the need to create a commission like this?
Well, the genesis of it, as I saw it, was over at Arizona Common Cause. Director there had spoke with his board at the time about the issues with redistricting, the secretness behind it, that it was occurring down in the basement of the state capitol with no public input, no public oversight. Common Cause reached out to some other groups, including the Valley Citizens League, the League of Women Voters, and others, and a coalition was formed, and the drafting process began. It was a wide-open drafting process with various drafts going out over emails to a wide range of people looking for input, and then the co-authors, of which I was one, put together the constitutional amendment and presented it to the voters.
Was there particular concern about how the lawmakers were doing, or to the fact that it just seemed so secretive, or was so secretive?
Well, it wasn't only the product, but it was also the process. It was both. It was both together. The process down in the basement of the Capitol, where the first and most important thing was the self-interest of the incumbents. First step being to throw a map up on the wall and using pins to locate the individual residences of the incumbents and to draw in where the existing boundaries were, such that, you know, any changes in boundaries that, the impact to an incumbent would be, immediately obvious. Also considerations were the opponents, perceived opponents in the next election. And the whole idea was to create safe districts for the incumbents, and quite often it was a process of both the minority and the majority party colluding together to do that. And then the product that was turned out was also one that was not popular with the public. It denied actual representation. It divided what we can call now communities of interest, and also many cities across the state, large and small. Particularly the small ones were hurt by being divided into several legislative districts, with the Democrats in a city being carved into one district and the Republicans being carved into the other. But then the city, that helps the incumbents, but basically then that community, their power disappears when they're divided that way.
So now we've had two cycles with the IRC in effect, regardless of what either major party thinks. Do you think the system has worked? Has it accomplished what it was supposed to?
Yes, I do believe it has worked, and it's, I think, worked quite well, both in the process and in the product as well. Under the process that we designed and that the voters adopted, it's come up from out of the basement. It's entirely done with public meetings that are open to the public across the state. Every meeting of the commission is that way. We've given them guidelines to work from, obviously, things like the Constitution, the Voting Rights Act, and those sorts of things. But we've also put into the requirements that they draw compact, contiguous districts, to the extent practicable, that they respect communities of interest, and that whenever possible, they are on the side of creating more competitive districts, which was one of the things that was seriously lacking before. Districts were so safe that there wasn't really any serious competition, no real choice for the voters on Election Day. But the process itself is much better now, and the public hearings that occur after the first round of maps, there's dozens of them held across the state, that where the public gets to come and comment on the draft maps, how they impact their community of interest, that sort of thing, really is the kind of sunshine and daylight that the process deserves. The product that's been produced has also, I think, been excellent. The case today, or Monday, oral arguments, is strictly about the redistricting of the congressional districts. Mm-hmm. The legislative districts are not at risk. The commission will exist and continue to do that. But on the congressional districts, if we take a look at those for a minute, there's 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Political scientists estimate that only 36 of those, plus or minus 36, are competitive, such that the registration turnout, one party or the other could actually win the seat depending on the strength of the candidate and the issues in play. Well, out of those 36 competitive seats, Arizona's got three. We've got almost 10% of the competitive seats in Congress, yet we have just slightly over 2% of all the total seats in Congress. So clearly there's something that's happening in Arizona that's providing voters more meaningful choices at the polls. And the thing that we have is we have an independent redistricting commission. Mm-hmm.
So clearly the high court is measuring the constitutionality of this. But from your standpoint, is this simply about politics and that the one side didn't like how this second cycle turned out?
It is interesting that there was a 12-year wait before the constitutionality of it was challenged, and that the challenge came after maps that were perceived to be not favorable to the majority party controlling the legislature, that the suit was filed at that time. One would think that if there was a true constitutional issue, that it would have been recognized right off the bat. The court's not only looking at the constitutionality of it, they're also evaluating whether the legislature has standing to bring the case for themselves, and also whether or not the underlying federal laws that relate to redistricting come into play here. And one of the things that's very important to understand is if they rule that the citizens through the initiative process don't have the right to affect the federal seats, there's a huge number, hundreds of laws across the country that do affect federal seats that have been put in through the initiative process, and it's going to be a continual rollback of that citizen democracy that's so important in keeping our process open.
Bart Turner is co-author of the ballot initiative that created the Independent Redistricting Commission here in Arizona. He was also recently elected to the Glendale City Council, and he joined us from Washington. Bart, thanks for the time.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks again.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're talking about Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission, the constitutionality of which was argued earlier this week before the U.S. Supreme Court. With me for a few minutes with his views is Doug McCachern, Arizona Republic editorial writer and columnist. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So, Doug, before we get into some of the specifics that Bart talked about, in general, do you think the IRC has accomplished what it was supposed to do when voters approved it?
Well, I think generally, I'm not going to give it, you know, an A+. I'd say overall, I think it's probably done its job as a truly independent, nonpartisan panel. For the most part, maybe I give it a C+. If you'll remember, it wasn't exactly there were real questions about its own nonpartisan nature when it was drawing legislative districts a few years ago, and a federal panel explicitly noted that there was questions about the partisan behavior of the commission.
Indeed. And Doug, I do wonder, though, because so much of what we talk about is politics, and I think it's always intriguing to look at that. When the first cycle came around, the thought was, at least, that Republicans had kind of outmaneuvered Democrats. The second time around, it was sort of the reverse. How much of that do you think comes into play here, whether it's fairness or whether it's this feeling that, well, there are many more registered Republicans, so why didn't we get more seats?
I heard Bart reference that, and I think it's a valid point in one respect. The question about just how truly unconstitutional Republicans feel it is. If they thought it was from the beginning, they could have raised their issue a month after the voters passed it, but they didn't because things turned out well for them the first time. But nevertheless, if it's unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional, and I think that the observations of the Supreme Court were pretty indicative of the fact that they've got real questions, but at least some of them have real questions as to its constitutionality.
I know there's the cynicism about whether independent is really something that can be accomplished or not. Just that word, the idea that there isn't going to be some sort of swing one way or the other. Just as human beings, this is how we're going to look at it. But when we think about in an ideal world, Doug, and forgive me for this, for putting on my little my slippers right now and sending us into dreamland here, but is there a situation where we could be, would we be better off overall with a commission that, in essence at least, is supposed to not have concerns about saving their own district or preserving their own seat?
Well, we've got two clashing interests here. We have the nature, the constitutional question, which doesn't really address that, but addressing that, let's both put our slippers on and take a look at it. And I would say, yes, I think we really have, there is really great value in having our districts as competitive as they possibly can be, which is one reason why a lot of Democrats have raised questions about minority-majority districts and just how intensely they should be gerrymandered in order to give preference to a minority candidate, because they recognize the fact that that really does dilute the opportunity for all districts to be competitive.
So, Doug, based on how the court rules, let's say in June it comes down that the court says, in fact, that the people suing do have standing, and then, in fact, the way the districts were drawn up was poorly done or not constitutionally done, let's put it that way. What sort of stress does that place on the system potentially?
Well, it depends on how narrow and how broadly their conclusion is. I tend to think it's going to be pretty narrowly drawn. I think that they'll give leeway to. I don't think that they're going to come out and say that commissions drawing these maps are unconstitutional on their face. Mm. But I think Arizona's, as it's designed, as well as perhaps California and one or two others, are going to have some issues.
And if they have issues then going forward, do we feel like this is something that we can get the parties to decide on? Do you think this is something that eventually becomes another voter initiative?
I would think it would go back to the voters. I would hope it would anyway. And I think voters, once they have a constitutionally approved process for turning it over to a panel, we'll do it again. I don't think that overall Arizona voters have got a real problem with this process for drawing district maps.
Doug McCachern, Arizona Republic editorial writer and columnist. Doug, we always appreciate the time. Thanks.
You bet, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with the outgoing head of the Arizona Department of Health Services, Will Humble. His last day on the job was yesterday. He's already casual, probably slept in a little bit today. We'll find out about his accomplishments and what is next for the agency. And then later on this hour, we'll find out about changes at the Morrison Institute. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust, helping children to become strong readers through Read On Arizona. More at pipertrust.org/literacy.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ, taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. Sunny skies and 31 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 39 in Prescott, sunny and 58 in Casa Grande. Cloudy skies in Tucson, where they have 57 degrees. It's fair and 65 in Yuma. Are you planning to buy a new car this year? Well, before you trade or sell your current vehicle, consider donating it to support the programs you love here on KJZZ. We'll take it away for free, and you get a tax deduction. To donate, go to cars.kjzz.org, and thanks. Skies are clear in the valley right now, and it's 60 degrees in Phoenix at 11:21.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Arizona Department of Health Service has been the go-to agency for the recent measles outbreak and preparing for a possible Ebola crisis. And when Arizona voters approved medical marijuana use, ADHS also implemented the policies. That means the responsibility fell to its director, Will Humble, or should I say former director. His last day on the job was yesterday. Will, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
So how relaxed are you right now?
I was telling my wife I feel 25 now. There's a lot of responsibility that comes with that director job, and it's been a long time since I've just been Will Humble, private citizen, and it kind of feels good.
Vaccination rates are something that came up fairly recently. People were concerned about the measles outbreak that apparently started at Disney. How concerned are you about the attitude in general in Arizona about vaccination?
Well, we've seen a decrease in our immunization rates over the last several years. Specifically, we have had an increasing number of parents who've decided to intentionally exempt their kids from the preschool and elementary school requirements for vaccinations. And it really has been a struggle over the last few years. But we implemented some interventions about 18 months ago where we changed – one of the things that we did was change the exemption form so that when a parent signs the exemption form, we're really requiring the parent to go through this checklist and acknowledge the fact that they understand the symptoms of these illnesses like measles and how serious the consequences can be, and ask them to initial each of the exemptions by vaccine and then sign the form at the bottom. The old form used to be so easy to do. It didn't trigger a conversation with the parent. This new form sort of drives that parent to think more carefully about the personal exemption before they sign. And just yesterday, actually, on my last day on the job, we got some good news from our immunization program that that continued increase in exemption rates actually stopped last year. Now, I'm not saying we are making progress to get back to where we were in 2004, but things are getting better. And quite honestly, you know, the measles outbreak that we had back in January and early February started a really important dialogue here in Arizona about the importance of vaccines. And in fact, so we looked at our vaccination data for January and we saw a 30% increase in the number of MMR vaccines that were given in January 15 compared to January 14. So, you know, that outbreak really got some parents thinking about the, you know, maybe I was wrong, you know, about this exemption, and maybe they went to some other sources and decided to really get their kids caught up, and hopefully a few parents changed their minds about, you know, exemptions altogether.
But do you think the state is a little bit too lax in what it allows as far as exemptions?
Well, that's really a public policy debate. You know, my job as director of the State Health Department is to really look at the statutes that the lawmakers have put together and try to design a public health system to take advantage of whatever statutory authority that we have. There are states, I think Mississippi is one, that doesn't allow a personal exemption at all, just like a medical exemption. Arizona isn't one of those states. Mm. And, you know, my attitude has always been, let's maximize our effectiveness as an agency and let the lawmakers make those policy decisions. And, you know, and so the messaging was really important during that measles outbreak. I was out front talking about the importance of vaccines. Bob England, the Maricopa County Public Health Director, did a great job really driving that message home. So I think, I think we're starting to turn the tide on this anti-vaccine trend.
One more vaccine-related question for you. You've been very out front, as one would think you would be in that position, about the influenza vaccine. Now, this time around, didn't seem to work that well, but it's still a good idea regardless, because a lot of people thought, well, I probably ended up perhaps still getting sick, maybe a milder form, but because the vaccine didn't quite sync up with the flu that we got here.
Yeah, so one of the things that happens during the flu season is that, the decisions for the August, September, October vaccine, so that the vaccine that'll be in the 2015 season this fall, that decision's going to be made in the next couple of months. And what they do is, you look at the surveillance globally and you look at the new strains and then identify what you think is your best bet for what strains to put in the flu vaccine for that year. And some years, many years, in fact, there's a really good match. In fact, the year before this flu season was a great match. This season wasn't as great a match because a new strain came on the scene sort of at the last minute. Influenza is a big public health issue, and the number one way that you can protect yourself, your community, and your family is to get the vaccine every year. And it's not going to ever be perfect, because that virus has figured out a way since the beginning of time to mutate in a way to trick humans' immune systems. The vaccine goes a long way towards changing that, and so it remains a really good intervention.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. That's the voice of Will Humble. He was the director of the Arizona Department of Health Services until yesterday. He says it's taken 30 years off his life, which is probably the scoop of this conversation so far. Will, the Medical Marijuana Act ended up getting a ton of attention. You were heavily involved in that, had to implement the system, had to make it work. How do you think it's doing right now based on how the policy was implemented? Do you think it's one of the better ones in the U.S.?
Well, just going by what my colleagues are saying, I think it's probably one of the model programs. We have an association called the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and we get together and meet periodically. And, this increasing trend of states having medical marijuana laws is the same in every state. It seems to be the state health department is the agency that ends up getting the responsibility to implement the program. And so some of those states have been coming to us over the last year and a half asking for advice, asking for our computer code, asking for us to let them know in advance where the landmines are. So we've helped New Hampshire, Illinois, Nevada, and Guam recently is just passing a medical marijuana program, and they're asking for advice. So we give them we built our computer code ourselves, and so it feels good to be able to just give that away to other jurisdictions. And I've always said, in state government, when it comes to identifying public health interventions and developing regulations and so forth, plagiarism is a virtue, not a vice. It really does help to figure out what the best practices are and copy them. And so there are some states that are copying what we've done. And by the way, you know, it's not like we're rocket scientists and we're the, you know, we looked at the other 14 states that came before Arizona and identified some best practices among those states as we built our regulations.
And you got hammered pretty hard by many of the pro-medical marijuana folks, and I'm not sure exactly what they were criticizing, but as a human being, as well as someone implementing the policy, how'd that make you feel?
Well, water off a duck's back, Steve. I mean, these health director jobs are the kinds of jobs where you have to keep your eye on the ball and follow through. You have your moral compass, you have your statutes and your regulations, and you do the best job that you can, recognizing that you're never going to make everybody happy. And the key is to make be true to yourself. Mm. And when it comes to the Medical Marijuana Act, I really wanted to be true to what the voters saw in the voter booth. When they connected that arrow and said yes on the Medical Marijuana Act, it said medical. It didn't say Adult Use Recreational Marijuana Act. Had it said that, that would be different. It said medical. And so from the very beginning, I thought, let's take them at their word, what they put on the ballot, and put together a medical program. And many of the patients wanted a recreational program. And that's not what it said in the ballot booth. And when people were filling that stuff out, you know, in their kitchens for the mail-in ballots, so I think we stayed true to that. But yeah, there was a lot of people that thought, oh, he's trying to undermine the act and this wasn't the intent. It should be free and easy. Well, we'll see in 2016 if they can get that on the ballot and passed, and then they can have their recreational program.
One of the accomplishments that you were given some credit for, also just Governor Brewer in general, that happened during your time as head of the department, had to do with behavioral health. What were some of the major steps that happened as far as how that could affect the community?
Yeah, there were two major accomplishments over the last 6 years. The first was an initiative that we started about 4 years ago to better integrate behavioral health care and acute and primary care for folks with a serious mental illness. Folks with a serious mental illness die 25 to 30 years earlier than folks without a mental illness, and they don't die from a psychiatric disorder. They die from, you know, untreated diabetes, cardiopulmonary illnesses, COPD that's gone without treatment and so forth. And one of our goals was to try to improve the level of care that folks with a serious mental illness get on the acute care side. And so it took us a couple of years to really be strategic about that, and we got a new contract out on the street. It's called an RFP, and we hired Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care here in Maricopa County, and that contract is underway now. October 1st of 2015, a similar contract will be in southern and northern Arizona with that integrated care concept. And we expect that to pay big dividends in both public health outcomes, but also reduce costs because you're treating those acute illnesses earlier before it ends up in an expensive hospitalization. So that was one major initiative. The other was to put to rest the Arnold versus Sarn lawsuit, which was a 32-year lawsuit, the longest one, I think, in state history. And we really took a strategic approach about how we wanted to end that suit. And we didn't want to lawyer our way out of it. We wanted to perform our way out of it. It's not about getting out of the suit. It's about performing to the level that folks expect. And so we built a settlement agreement with the plaintiffs that ties performance of the system to what are called the SAMHSA fidelity models for supported employment, supported housing, peer and family support, and ensure that the services that we're delivering are actually helping to improve the quality of life for the folks for the folks that we serve. And we were able to actually get that settlement done. And so that was a huge accomplishment.
Well, one thing you mentioned was the phrase lowering costs. And that, of course, is always a concern. The state budget is back in the hole. Do you think enough money is put toward the department in general or public health in general in the state?
Well, let me just talk nationally. That's a good question. In the U.S., we spend 96% of our health dollars on health care. So 4% goes to prevention and public health. But when you look at what actually keeps populations of people healthier, it's the prevention. It's that, like I talked, the stitch in time saves nine concept. It's if you can keep populations of people healthier, you save at the back end. Tobacco use is a perfect example of that. Yeah. Very little money is spent nationwide. We're fortunate to have some voter-protected money for smoking cessation. But when you get smokers to quit, you are saving a lot of downstream dollars 15 or 20 years from now. So that's a perfect example of a really good public health investment that pays dividends in a decade or two.
Well, finally, you came at this job as someone who was in communications for a while before this as well, before you became director. How important do you think it is for the director to be someone who can communicate well with the public and is willing to do that to really put a public face on some of these things?
Well, I think it's an important... It's important for agencies to have a credible spokesperson who understands how to talk in a way that the community understands. Now, in my case, that's one of the things that I'm pretty good at, and I happen to be director. But if you've got a director that doesn't feel comfortable in that forum, that's okay. As long as you have like a chief medical officer that can fill that role, or as long as you've got somebody in upper leadership that can fill the role, I think that's okay. What is a mistake is for folks in these jobs, like director jobs, to be afraid of the media. And I've seen that before. Mm-hmm. People in senior leadership aren't familiar with the media. They get afraid that they're going to get burned, and so they miss opportunities to tell their story. And one of the key things that we need to do in public health is tell our story. So much of what we need to have happen is to get to the grassroots level, to get folks to understand the things that they can personally do to improve their health status, like stopping smoking, having better physical activity, nutrition, et cetera.
Will Humble was director of the Arizona Department of Health Services until today, when I guess he slept in.
You didn't? The school bus comes at 6:45, so...
Well, Will, thanks as always, and good luck.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the director of the Morrison Institute, and later on this hour, we'll find out why Arizona is, yes, like a chimichanga. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Summit Law School, now enrolling for its part-time evening JD program designed for working professionals seeking to change careers or advance in their current field. azsummitlaw.edu/options.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. Valley forecast calling for mostly sunny skies, a high of 69 degrees. It'll be clear overnight with a low in the very low 40s. You may need a sweater tonight. Sunny skies tomorrow, high of 72, and more sunshine on Friday and on into the weekend. We're expecting clear skies, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. Well, join us at noon for Here and Now from Boston. We'll get reaction to the Justice Department's report that the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, systematically violated its black citizens' rights. And a new book explains that how and when you tap into Social Security benefits can dramatically change how much money you get. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. We proudly recognize members of our Leadership Society, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks Hilliard, for their support of news and information on KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. 60 degrees right now in the valley, under fair skies. It's 11:38 at KJZZ.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Morrison Institute for Public Policy at ASU isn't new, but when you consider Morrison has a new water policy center and a new quarterly public poll, it may seem that way. With me to talk about the Morrison mission is Institute Director Tom Riley. Tom, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Steve, thanks for having me.
We talked about the initial quarterly poll last week with Dave Doherty, and there are some new numbers that came out, I know, in the last day or so. Don't want to spend too much time on it, but I did want to ask you one question that came up, which is the reaction of Arizona, people who were polled on illegal immigration. Some of the results were interesting, I thought.
Yeah, mixed results, not surprisingly. They're, and not surprisingly, too, it's been more aligned to a political party, but not necessarily ethnicity. But I think it just underscores that many individuals in Arizona are conflicted on the issue.
What do you think the mission of the Morrison Institute is? I think at times people in the past thought of it as a think tank, and I don't know if that's a fair assessment or not, but when you think of Morrison, when you came in here, what did you want it to be?
Well, I think, you know, that is an accurate representation. We do a lot of thinking. We're a think tank. But we also attempt to take those public policy issues that are most important to individuals in Arizona and in the Southwest and try to package them in a way to engage the average citizen, to make it interesting, exciting, and take complex issues and boil them down in a way that people can engage in that conversation.
When they're engaging in that conversation, how important is it then to get them sort of revved up to do something or to talk to their member of the legislature, a member of Congress about these things?
Yeah, well, we definitely want to spend a lot of time about education and civic engagement, but also identifying avenues where citizens can feel engaged. And let me give you an example, is that we initially have started a process about the Citizens Initiative process where we're attempting to engage many citizens to understand the ballot initiative process. Many individuals don't know where to go to find accurate, independent information. During this last city election on the topic of pensions, we brought together a representative sample of individuals over a three-day period, brought them together to discuss the issue of pensions, which can be a very complex and weighty issue.
Yeah.
What we found is that there's just a hunger for individuals to know where to go to kind of look at the pros and cons and conflicting statements from both sides and process that information and to share that with others.
Well, independent is a key word there because I think people want to know or at least feel comfortable that they're getting unbiased, trustworthy information.
And we look at in the 2016 election, we'll probably have several big initiatives on the ballot question. So we hope to replicate what we did in the Phoenix area to statewide issues and provide some information to the general public about how to understand some of these complex ballot initiatives.
Tom, I mentioned the new Water Policy Center, which, I mean, water in the desert here is a vital thing. I wonder, going forward with that, is that something that has to be short and long term as far as a mission goes, or is that just sort of we have to be ready for what comes in 20 years, or should we start thinking about what comes in the next 2 or 3 years?
Good question. I think we need to deal with both. I mean, one obviously is the long-term goal is to really kind of secure and address some of the challenges about how we're going to secure water and how we're going to pay for it. But as you know, in order to get to that, we also have to decide who has the water rights and in what priority. So to that end, on a very short-term initiative, we're attempting to make some leeway into the adjudication process that's kind of been bogged down for the last 40 years in this kind of way process. And we're attempting to see if we can identify some more expeditious alternative ways so we can get to the issue after we determine who has priority to help secure some of those long-term solutions to our water challenges.
How important do you think it is that policymakers and other sort of general stakeholders also look at Morrison as a trustworthy place where they can say, okay, they're trying to get the best information, the most information that doesn't lean one way or the other.
And I think that's critical important. And we pride ourselves on the ability of being kind of the premier think tank that addresses issues in a very nonpartisan, independent, and evidence-based manner. Mm-hmm. Many of the topics that we deal with, people perhaps are not satisfied on both sides, but our goal is to kind of take these public policy issues, boil them down in a manner, provide some good information for people to base their discussion, and then help them and assist them in involving the conversation. A good example is, you know, the independent voter. So for the first time in the past year, the independent voter now has surpassed those that identify themselves with either major party as Democrat and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a lot of angst about who those independent voters are. We received some funding. We're actually looking at that topic to kind of do a little deeper dive and provide some evidence around who those independent voters are, why they chose not to align themselves with one political party, how they vote, what their political philosophy is. I think this type of information will be very useful for many individuals.
Right, because there is that perspective by some that means that, oh, you're in the middle somewhere. Well, in many cases, it can mean that you're far right, far left, or in the middle.
Exactly, and I think that there's been a lot of analysis and predictions about what impact the independent voter will have. And I'm not sure many of them have panned out to what many of the individuals have thought.
Tom, last couple of thoughts. What sort of expansion possibilities might there be if Morrison can really get out there and make an impact? Is it possible you can have more fellows, more researchers, more people really getting out in the community?
Well, we're looking at also, you know, identifying those issues that are most important, but also those emerging issues. And we're also trying to engage many others, younger populations, and through social media and other avenues to help them find a voice and a way to engage in that conversation. Because so many of the issues that we face, whether it's water, whether it's immigration or education, aren't just defined to the state boundary of Arizona. We're looking also to address some of these issues from a Mountain West and Southwest perspective. To that end, we have aligned ourselves and some of our national advisors who serve on the board of both with the Brookings Institute and the Pew Charitable Trust Foundation. Those organizations who address public policy on a national, international basis provide us a lot of comparisons ways to kind of look at Arizona in the context of some of these really important issues.
Very interesting. Tom Riley is the director of the Morrison Institute at ASU. Tom, thanks for the time.
Thanks for inviting me.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Whether you've lived in Arizona for a short time or for decades, you've undoubtedly found yourself wanting to explore. It could be in the desert or the high country, but this unique collection of places made you want to learn more. In his new book, Chasing Arizona, author Ken Lamberton spent an entire year digging into the state's people and places. Lamberton joins me now from Bisbee. Why is there a chimichanga on the cover of the book? Did you have a say in that?
Oh, yeah. The chimichanga on the cover, yeah, it caused a bit of controversy, mostly with my wife and others who thought that there should be like a Kia Rio on the cover. I drove 21,000 miles across the state in this little Kia Rio, and they thought the Kia kind of represented what the book would be about, you know, that it was a travel narrative. But the press came up with the chimichanga. And when I saw that, I laughed, and I knew, well, you know, they get it. They know what the book is about, you know. And there's stories throughout the book about the chimichanga. I mean, there was, in 2012, when I was doing the research, that year, our centennial year, there was a competition among Macayos in Phoenix and El Charro in Tucson about who actually invented the chimichanga, and both had their stories. Monica Flynn had a story about dropping it into a deep fryer, and Woody Johnson the same sort of story. So I decided I would chase them across the state, try to find out the best chimichanga in Arizona, and I sort of came to the conclusion that the chimichanga, with its layers of taste and history, the chimichanga was Arizona, so that's why it's on the cover, and the press figured that out pretty easily, I think.
So, Ken, how long have you been an Arizona resident?
Since I was 9 years old, so it's been close to 50 years.
When did you notice that it had a real hold on you?
From childhood. I mean, I was mesmerized by the place, and this was like the late 60s, when my parents just allowed me to explore. And I spent whole days on my bike just riding around in the desert. I lived up on the northwest side of Tucson, and so I had all this desert in my background. I had the front range of the Catalina Mountains as a backyard, and I just spent the time exploring it. And, you know, it was, in the beginning, it was a little rough, probably rough on me, rough on the desert a bit. I mean, I think, you know, some of my experiences involved killing things, you know, as a child, but eventually the desert kind of grew on me, and I began to really respect it.
Well, when you say respect, that's an interesting word to use. You had to grow to respect it. Is that something, as we're a place that has so many transients or folks from other places, what are the challenges of getting them to respect it?
I think part of learning to respect any place is to understand it first. You know, and that's my growth, my background was coming to understand this place, and part as a naturalist. I mean, I took biology at the University of Arizona, and I became a naturalist of sorts to this place, and I think that's where my respect for it grew out of. I wasn't necessarily a people person before I started this book, but I decided that I was going to get out there and I was going to just talk to people and find out their stories. I already knew the history. I knew a lot of the history about Arizona, but I wanted to know the history of the people who lived here, and so I would just ask them, and it was amazing what I learned.
How dramatic are the differences between people based on where they may live in Arizona or what they've devoted their lives to in Arizona? Did you find out that it didn't necessarily matter where they lived, or was there quite a difference?
The people that I encountered loved this place, no matter where they, if they were in Kingman and they were new to the place, they loved it. If they were living along the border where I live in Bisbee, so I'm very close to the border. I mean, and they may love it for different reasons, but they did. People in Phoenix, they loved that town.
Ken, you wrote so many interesting things about what I'll categorize as wildlife. Are there a couple of stories you can tell us to sort of whet people's appetites about some of the more interesting creatures you saw or you were in search of?
I had decided early on that I wanted to chase all the symbols that are Arizona, that say something about Arizonans. And we have 12 of them. And they include Arizona tree frog, a two-tailed swallowtail butterfly, and the ridge-nose rattlesnake. That is our state reptile. You know, it could have been something like a Gila monster. Very sexy, beautiful animal, and I saw lots of Gila monsters during 2012. But the ridge-nose rattlesnake lives in some small little canyons in the Huachuca Mountains along the border. It's very reclusive, only comes out for a few months of the year, very hard to find. And I spent like 4 separate weekends with a friend of mine who actually lived in a cave for 8 years, so he was great fun to be with, and searching for this thing. I mean, poking into holes, rolling over logs, going up and down these canyons in the Huachuca Mountains, looking for this small rattlesnake. And then on the last day when I've given up and we're driving out, there in the forest road is the ridge-nose rattlesnake, all coiled up, just sitting there waiting for me. It was like a gift. It was the most amazing thing, but, typical too, right? You spend all this time doing something, and then it's in the road, on your way out.
This was such an intense part of your life, experiencing these places, and then, of course, to follow up and write it. When you knew that the year was done, the trips were done, how did it make you feel?
It felt like a major accomplishment. When 2012 was over, basically I knew I'd gotten through the year. I knew then that there was a big chunk of writing yet to come. And I had journals that were just filled and lots of notes. And I'd stuffed, all kinds of notes in various places. And so now I had to kind of conceptualize how I wanted to present this year in the book. And so there was the relief of, it's the end of the year and I made it through there. But there was also this pressure now, I want to finish the writing so that, so we can get this published in a timely manner, And as it was, it came out in 2015, this year. So there was about a year and a half in the process of actually writing the book.
Ken Lamberton, he's the author of Chasing Arizona, One Man's Year-Long Obsession with the Grand Canyon State. Ken, thank you and good luck.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Arizona Coyotes got a new name this year, a new majority owner, and now with the passing of this week's National Hockey League trade deadline, a lot of new players. When we talk hockey on this program, we often turn to Todd Walsh of Fox Sports Arizona and the Arizona Coyotes Radio Network. Not only does he know the Coyotes, he also was heavily involved in the 35th anniversary celebration of the U.S. men's hockey team's Miracle on Ice, which we'll talk about as well in a couple of minutes. Todd, good morning.
Good to be with you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
So, Todd, it's been a rough season for the Coyotes, and I know you don't like to make yourself part of the story, but does that make it any different, more difficult to deal with coaches, players in the locker room?
Sure. I mean, winning is the great deodorant, and we're all vested in what's going on. Our lives are infinitely easier and better when we're covering you know, winning teams, and you feel the wave on both sides of the spectrum, to be sure. It's still a good group, though, and they respect our jobs. They've always been very respectful of what we do and how we go about doing it. We're with them every step of the way, you know, as a partner. So we're on the team charters, we're in the team hotels, on the team buses. So you can't help but live that. The challenge is always, A, don't take it home with you, but B, also understand that you're a part of the process here. Your job is to tell their story and just to tell it fairly and make sure that the lines of communication are open. I think we've always done a pretty good job of that.
Does it take a passion and a personal passion to talk about the games, talk about the sports in a way that is really about storytelling and not just sort of the meat and potatoes? Because that's, I think, one of your strengths is really making it a story.
Well, I'm just fundamentally afraid of hard work and, you know, reading statistical breakdowns. So I've just sort of cheated my way through that and decided I'd just call myself a storyteller, just full candor there.
Yeah.
So, I'd rather tell a story about a guy's journey and I'd rather talk about maybe what it was like to play in a game in a special place against this unique opponent than talk about the power play and why it broke down. I think that's not something that that has lasting power and a shelf life and fans in their head. I've always kind of felt like if you can dig a little deeper and get a little more obtuse, that they'll probably remember that. And I've been holding on to that for my entire career, so I hope I'm right.
One more specific question about the Coyotes before we move on. And so-called rebuilding situations are always difficult initially. I guess I wonder when a team trades established players like a Keith Yandle, for example, does that actually indicate the organization might be patient, that they're going to get back some good young players, and that's a good sign that, hey, stick with us as we rebuild? Is that in some ways a better plan?
I don't know if it's patience. I think the one thing is it's reality now, and I think that, you know, over the years before this current regime was in place, there was a kind of a stall. And there was an inability to look in the mirror and say, you know what, it's not working here. We've got to go down to get up. And that's the big challenge for professional sports teams and franchises, that they actually say, all right, you know what, this is failing us, or circumstances have changed in the particular sport that we have. We've got to reinvent ourselves. There's a lot of, you know, job security is not just an issue for players. It's for upper management and coaches as well. And a lot of things are you know, dictated because of that. And I think sometimes you got people in power that want to stay in power, and they're going to be in job protection mode instead of having the courage to do what I think the Coyotes just did, which was, you know what, we've got to go down to get up, and here's our plan, and we're going to use our assets to bring back bigger and more potentially long-term assets and go on with that. I've seen them fail before. This was a bold move, a very hard move, a difficult move right now, but I think if you really look at it and you really observe what's been going on and you realize the depth of the draft and the generational type players that are available in the next two drafts, this is a good plan. And it's the hardest ones sometimes are the ones that you hold on to and say, all right, this is what we're doing, and stay to it.
Todd, late last month you were the MC of the 35th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice men's Olympic hockey team. Cliff's Notes version about how that happened. How did you make that connection?
Well, I've been stalking them since February of 1980 in my driveway in upstate New York. That's true. I started my radio broadcasting career in Tucson in 1987, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was hosting a talk show Monday through Friday, and it was February, and I always had a special place in my heart for that team. And I remember I cold called Mike Ruzioni and Jim Craig on the anniversary of it, and ever since then, and no matter what form of broadcasting that I was in, every February I would do something. So I started to cultivate relationships. And it kind of, I thought I hit the pinnacle when I was on the red carpet for the movie Miracle premiere in Hollywood years ago. But it just kept evolving. And then the Coyotes brought a group of 10 guys there last year for a pre-Olympic send-off. And I had sort of an idea on something I saw that and heard Mike Ruzioni say in a short little gathering we had with season ticket holders when he said, we've never done this. We've never talked about just the game. So that was kind of my idea, was I'd like to do that someday. And then there were other people involved that were trying to put together a group of guys as one. in that event spawned that, and then a phone call and a conversation, and the next thing you know, I'm standing at Herb Brooks Arena in Lake Placid introducing the team. That's the short version of it. It was an out-of-body experience.
Todd, finally, we've got about a minute or so left. So you're a kid in upstate New York in 1980. Since then, you've covered probably most of the big sporting events there are to be covered. But does that one still hold for you as the most impactful one in your life?
Oh, yeah. It was the greatest, yes, by far. Nothing will ever approach it. I think for anybody that was of a certain age at that time, holds that moment near and dear to their heart. And the coolest thing about this story is it has legs now. The movie, I think, recreated a whole nother backdrop and a whole nother series of fans. Like, now you've got parents that are able to talk about that moment, and then they show the movie. So when I looked out in the audience that night, I saw people my age with their children that were teenagers, and they